Today's episode is brought to you by Wise, the account that helps you manage your money around the world, which is huge for travelers. I've been a customer and a fan for 10 years. The Wise account helps you send, spend, and receive in different currencies fast, and they do it all without hidden fees or exchange rate markups. This service has been so critical for me in my life as a traveler, as a nomad, as somebody living abroad. And you can join 16 million customers and learn how the Wise account can help you out on the road at wise.com/travel. That's Wise, WISE.com/travel, or download the app. This episode of Zero to Travel is brought to you by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder with 7 drive modes. The Pathfinder's available intelligent 4x4 is built for even the most epic journeys. Learn more at NissanUSA.com. Today, you'll explore life and travel in the city of 10,000 shrines, Kyoto, Japan.
To talk about the history of Kyoto a little bit, it's one of the only cities that wasn't destroyed during World War II. So you still have a lot of the older architecture. In addition to that, it's kind of always been known as the cultural capital of Japan. Very traditional, very old city.
And we dig into some of those traditions and places to see if you're visiting with my guest, Taro Moberly, a street and travel photographer who you just heard from, based in Kyoto, Japan. His book, In Kyoto, guides readers through the many faces of his adopted hometown and Japan's cultural and spiritual heart. During our chat, we also discuss photography as an act of creative expression.
Photography has kind of been my way of expressing how I feel, how I see the world around me.
And if you've ever thought about moving abroad to a country that is part of your heritage or your family background, your roots, and reconnecting with that, or maybe connecting with that for the first time, you'll discover how Taro ended up moving to Japan to connect with his family heritage and why he stuck around. We also get into some of the unique nuances of Japanese culture and even answer the question how you can move to Japan if that's something you want to do.
The easiest way to move to Japan, if you're coming from any other country, really, the easiest way is to...
You'll have to tune in to hear the answer to that question and much more coming your way today. Plus, I'll give you a song to pair this episode with. Maybe you can guess which song it is. Perhaps. We'll see. Plus, a thoughtful Japanese proverb to send you on your way to a productive week. And a shout out to somebody in this community who's adjusting to their new life on the road. All that happening in today's episode right now. So buckle up, strap in. Thanks for being here. And yokosa to the Zero to Travel podcast, my friend.
You're listening to the Zero to Travel podcast, where we explore exciting travel-based work, lifestyle, and business opportunities, helping you to achieve your wildest travel dreams. And now your host, world wanderer and travel junkie, Jason Moore.
Hey, what's up? It's Jason here with ZeroToTravel.com. Welcome to the show. Thanks for hanging out, letting me bring a little travel into your ears today. This is the show to help you travel the world on your terms to fill your life with as much travel as you desire, no matter what your situation or experience. Are you enjoying Destinations Month? January is all about destinations, a good time to start getting those travel dreams churning again, figuring out where you might want to go this year and the next couple years. And we're continuing that with a trip to Kyoto, Japan today, a place that I've been dying to visit for a long time that I know I'll get to one day. Of course, much more going on in this conversation than just the destination piece, but we do get some tips on what to see, what makes Kyoto such a special city, being really the cultural and spiritual heart of Japan. And just a couple notes before we dive in. If you want something to accompany this show, I would recommend you check out Taro's website, either taromoberly.com, we'll link to that in the show notes, or his Instagram, where you can see some of the pictures from Kyoto, and that way you can kind of get a little bit of the visual vibe on some of the things we're discussing and some of those small but magical moments we witness as travelers that we touch on in our conversation today. Just one of the many things that comes up. I hope you enjoy it. Stick around on the back end if you'd like. We'll leave you with a Japanese proverb, something that we can all carry through with us for the rest of the year. A shout out to a listener and a little song pairing to close it out if you're so inclined. So without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Taro. Thanks for listening, for being here today, and I'll see you on the other side, my friend. How many of these podcasts have you done?
Grand total of zero. This is the first one.
Yeah. No way.
Yeah.
Zero to Travels, your first ever podcast?
Zero to podcast. So yeah, if I make mistakes here and there, I apologize.
You can't make a mistake if you're just having a conversation and being honest. So
True.
This is a mistake-free zone as long as you bring the bring yourself and a smile. Welcome to the show, man. This is the show. It's happening right now.
Are we going? No, thanks for having me.
We're going. I'm really excited to have you because Kyoto is a place that I've never been, and it's definitely on the so-called bucket list or live list or whatever you want to call it, life list of places to go. Of course, I should formally say Taro Moberly, welcome to the Zero to Travel podcast, my friend, a street and travel photographer based in Kyoto, Japan. And we're going to get into your story a bit today because I want to hear how you ended up where you ended up from California, which I guess we should start with California. Like, did you grow up in a city there or small town? Where were you?
Yeah, born and raised in the San Francisco Bay Area. Lived there for most of my youth, I guess. All of my youth. And went down to San Luis Obispo, which is halfway between San Francisco and LA for university. I'm a California boy, born and raised.
I remember the first time going to San Francisco. It was always a place I had wanted to visit, and I got this touring job, and they're like, well, you have a week off. You guys want to, you know, tell us where to fly you home. And I was like, can we go somewhere else? Do we have to go home? And they were like, yeah, we'll fly you wherever. And I was like, San Francisco, baby. And went out there and just fell in love with the city.
Nice.
You know, like went to City Lights bookstore and walked around, you know, saw the Golden Gate Bridge, the whole thing. And it's so charming. And I'm just wondering, I guess, what it was like to grow up in that city.
So I actually grew up not in the city itself, but kind of south. I grew up near San Jose, which is where it's like where all the tech companies are, right?
Yeah, so
like
okay.
Apple, Google.
Silicon Valley.
Silicon Valley, exactly. So growing up around that area is kind of just around computers most of my life, right? Like my dad worked for a big tech company. And just growing up, we just had computers all around the house. Even if you go to my parents' house now, there's like a computer. There's three computers in every room, right? Definitely had a lot of that exposure growing up. And even kind of as more of an adult, like there's a lot of that like entrepreneurial spirit going around. Like people are trying to have the next big tech startup. So you see a lot of that going around. I enjoy tech. I love like computers and things like that. I've never gotten too into it. A lot of my friends would get into like programming and coding and things like that. I've dabbled with it. I played around with it. Ultimately, it's not something that I can stay focused on. It's not quite for me, but yeah, it's definitely really fun to watch, I think. The city itself, San Francisco, is definitely a lot of fun to hang out in. It's definitely a very quirky city. I don't know. For example, I recently took a friend there. They're super surprised to see like, you know, people walking around naked in the street, or you'll see like a bike, like a group of people riding bikes by, and no one's wearing clothes, and it's shocking to people who've never seen it before, right? So things like that. It kind of makes it an interesting place to hang out.
Yeah, it sounds like, I mean, from what I've heard, people have been getting priced out of there for a while now. which is super sad.
Yeah. One of the most expensive places in the country. I think what, like New York, the Hamptons might be one up on that. But yeah, with all the tech companies coming in, obviously there's a lot of money there. So it's just been raising prices for housing and things like that. Luckily for my parents, like they have a house there, and it's just gaining in value, I suppose. They've been living there since before I was born. So it hasn't really affected them as much, but you definitely see it all around.
It's interesting to hear that your friends were coding and into all that. I just always wonder how much of an impact the environment has on your direction in life, you know? But you, even growing up in the heart of Silicon Valley, you're a photographer, so you went a different way in many ways. How did that come about for you?
Photography was something that I've had some interest in it basically since I was a kid. Not as a photographer itself, but as a fan of photography, right? So my family always subscribed to, say, like National Geographic magazine and things like that. And I remember looking through the magazine pages and just being amazed at not only the content of the photo, but just kind of the art of the photo itself. My family has kind of had a long history with art. My aunts and uncles, there's a lot of like painters, people who are into like more contemporary art. So yeah, there's a lot of, I've been surrounded by art just through my family growing up. But photography was kind of the art form that I was always the most interested in. I never really started taking photos until kind of later in life. I did it on and off. Like I took photo classes in high school and things like that. But I think when I moved to Japan is when I really kind of embraced photography as something that I enjoy doing. So that's kind of been the story there. Yeah.
Well, yeah, was part of that not just embracing the craft of like, oh, I really enjoy doing this, I'm going to make an effort to do it, but then embracing, I don't know, perhaps the identity of a photographer, right? It's like, okay, not only am I going to do this, but I'm going to try to pursue a career in this, which I think is another level of sort of personal commitment, perhaps. But I can't speak for your experience. You got to tell me where your head was then.
Yeah. Well, actually, photography for me still isn't a career. I actually have a day job, which is...
Nobody hates on the side hustle here, Taro.
Yeah. yeah, photography for me has just been something that... It's been a form of self-expression. I'm a pretty introverted guy. I don't really speak too much. Usually I only really open up to people that are really close to me or after I've had a few beers. but photography has kind of been my way of expressing kind of how I feel, how I kind of see the world around me, I suppose.
It's another form of communication for you, essentially. What is that? Yeah, what does that communicate for you that you can't do in other ways?
I don't know. Like being on a podcast right now, it's kind of weird to say, but I've never really been strong with words. I'm not a good verbal communicator. Just something visually about photography. I could look at a photo and I don't know, kind of read into the story behind the photo, right? Like what's going on in the photo. They say a photo can tell what, like a picture can say 1,000 words or whatever the saying is. It's absolutely true to me, right? If I look at a photo, I try to think like, oh, what was going through their head when they took this? Like, why did they take this? You know, and there's so much about it. Like what's the subject? What's the, even the lighting of the photo, everything is there for a reason. Usually it's there for a reason, right? So it's like, why is it like that? And in my own photography, that's kind of what I try to express as well.
One of my favorite parts of travel is, or living abroad, or really just wandering around anywhere, is kind of seeing these small vignettes kind of play out. You want to look at them like that. It's a moment in somebody's life that you happen to just walk by. It doesn't even have to be, I mean, it can be just a mundane moment, but something about it to you. I'm not sure what it is, like what attracts you to a moment that makes you want to capture it, I guess would be the question.
It's hard to say. even for me, it's hard to answer, right? It's like you kind of see it and you just know it.
Something special.
Yeah. And for me, especially as living in Kyoto now, something I want to express with my photography is just kind of what is life like here, right? For a lot of my people who are looking at my photos, they probably don't live in Kyoto. Most of them don't even live in Japan. So just kind of, I want to express kind of what is like daily life like? Like, what does the world look like here? What will they see if they were walking in my shoes or if they were just walking through the city? And yeah, seeing people on the street that have like a moment to themselves, right? Like you see them and kind of wonder like, what are you thinking right now? Or what's going through your head right now, right? What's your story is what I'm getting at. And hopefully with my photography, I could kind of show a little bit of that story.
It's interesting we have that in common because, you know, this is where I do it right here
through the podcast.
Right. Yeah. I just want to hear people's story and hear their perspectives. And it's so nice to share that with people. Why is it so nice to express yourself and share things as a human? Why is that? Why do we have that innate desire? I feel like if I'm not doing that for an extended period of time, something definitely feels off for me.
Yeah, well, they say humans are social animals, right?
Yeah, but you could argue that what you do is not, you know, it may not be super social if you're, I don't want to use the term lurking. If you're lurking around the corner, taking a picture of somebody in an alley doing something, lurking's the wrong word, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, No, yeah. It kind of is what it is. I have a bunch of other street photography friends and, you know, people post photos on Instagram and things like that. And the comments are always like, oh, you're the best lurker out there and stuff like that. That's what it is.
Okay. So I did use the right word. Great.
Yeah. Hopefully it's not as creepy as it sounds, but.
Well, you're doing it in a different way, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, had you traveled a lot before you moved to Japan? And I do want to hear why you ended up living there in the first place, but
So I've been very fortunate. When I was young, my parents would take me kind of all around the world, really. I shouldn't say that. Maybe it was mostly to Asia. You might be able to tell by my name, Taro. Taro is actually a Japanese name. So my mother's family is from Japan and my mom grew up actually here in Kyoto. So when I was young, we spent a lot of time here in Japan, traveling around and to other places as well. Ultimately, my parents decided that they just like really warm tropical islands. So we ended up going to Fiji like every year, which like looking back, I think I probably didn't appreciate it enough. I could go for a vacation in Fiji right now. But yeah, so yeah. And then which kind of brings me to why I'm here now. So being here, kind of visiting during summer vacations as a kid, visiting family and kind of touring around the country, I really kind of wanted to experience what it's like to not just visit for a summer, but try to like live here, you know. Ultimately, I wanted to spend a couple of years and kind of experience the culture on a deeper level than just visiting, kind of learn about my heritage a little bit more, get to know my family on my mom's side more. My grandmother is still going hard. She's over in Kyoto. She's here in Kyoto. And I have other family around as well. So I kind of get closer with them and get to know them on a level that I didn't get to as a child. So that's kind of the reason why I chose to come here. And in 2015, I'd graduated college and I was working for a couple of years. I was doing kind of online marketing for a sports retailer, mostly working with like running equipment, running shoes and things like that. But I just kind of had an opportunity to come and move to Japan, and I took it and I'm here. And yeah, originally I was only supposed to, in my mind, I thought I was only going to be here for like a year or two. But that was 2015. So 7 years later, and I'm still around. Haven't left yet.
Wow. What brought you there? Was it a work opportunity or?
Yeah. So, the easiest way to move to Japan, if you're coming from any other country, really, the easiest way is to come in teaching English. And that's the route that I took originally. There's a number of like different ways that you can teach English. A lot of people will kind of get a job with like a private teaching or private school, I guess, like an English language classroom. It's called like an eikaiwa in Japanese. But they're like private lessons, usually with adults or with kind of students that are practicing for a college entrance exam or some sort of other test. The route I took was actually going through, it's called being an ALT, assistant language teacher. And that's a position where you actually work in a Japanese public school, teaching English to classrooms full of kids. So that's what I did when I first arrived in Japan. And it's kind of something that I stuck with for a while. I'm still involved with the ALT industry, I guess you can say. I'm more of a supporter now. So my company, actually, the company I work for is a dispatch company for ALTs, and our clients are kind of the boards of educations in different cities throughout Japan. And I help new ALTs kind of get situated, kind of familiarize them with the working culture here in Japan, and kind of help them out in the classroom as well. So yeah, I'm still involved with that. That's my day job. Nothing to do with photography.
If somebody was interested in pursuing that route, just quickly, could you share like a resource or two that would be helpful, if you can think of any offhand?
Yeah. So the most common, I guess the most popular program that people do it through is called the JET program. JET, I don't stand for Japanese English teacher. I actually don't know what it stands for, but it's a government funded program. It's quite competitive from what I hear. And you have to interview abroad. If you get selected, they bring you over and they will put you in a school or two, maybe three. But they take care of you, I think. From what I've heard, they pay relatively well. They kind of help you out with housing, things like that. Yeah, I actually work for a private company that's okay. A competitor to the JET program. So they'll probably be super upset if they heard that I was promoting
them.
Well,
you can mention the company.
Yeah, so it's called Interac, and it's the largest private ALT company here in Japan. I guess so it'd be second to the JET program. So it's Interac, like Interact without the T at the end. And it's the same deal. Like most people will come from overseas, they'll get hired overseas, they'll come to Japan, and then they will get placed in a kind of a random city. You get some choice in terms of where you end up, but for the most part, it's kind of like we have a position in this city up on this island. Enjoy it.
You got to be open for an experience. It looks Absolutely. Like the website's interactnetwork.com. Is that right?
That sounds right. Yeah.
It looks like it. And the other one is, yeah, the Japan Exchange and Teaching Program. We'll link to all these in the show notes. And of course, your website and your Instagram and everything like that as well. It's great. You know, you never know if somebody's listening that they're like, hey, this sounds interesting. Like, maybe this is a way to go to Japan. Then just like to get a couple resources there. But
For sure.
We'll be right back. This episode of Zero to Travel is presented by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. From muddy jungle paths and snowy trails to rolling sand dunes, the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder has the capability to take you to some of the most epic destinations on Earth. We're excited to partner with Nissan because our listeners know we love to celebrate the joy of exploring the world and finding the best off-the-beaten-path destinations to visit. And there's no better vehicle for that than the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. With 7 drive modes, the Pathfinder's available intelligent 4x4 is built for even the most epic journeys, and it even has the best towing capacity in its class, up to 6,000 pounds, so you can bring the fun with you. But Nissan also knows that it's not just about where you go. In a Pathfinder, the real fun comes from getting there, and that's something we love celebrating here on the Zero to Travel podcast. We believe that life is about finding that joy within the journey itself, and that's why we're thrilled to partner with Nissan to celebrate adventurers everywhere. So thanks again to Nissan for sponsoring this episode of Zero to Travel and for the reminder to chase bigger, better, more exciting adventures and enjoy the ride along the way. Learn more at NissanUSA.com. Now let's get back to the show. I want to hear about life in Kyoto. You said you came to experience life in Japan and specifically in Kyoto. So tell us about it. Like, what is life like there? I'm really curious.
Yeah. Well, Kyoto itself, I feel, is a very unique city. It's something that kind of drew me to it as a child. It's a very traditional city. I think that's what people hear about it the most. There's tons of like temples, old like shrines. There's a lot of culture in Kyoto. I think kind of to talk about the history of Kyoto a little bit, it's one of the only cities that, wasn't destroyed during World War II. So you still have a lot of the older architecture. In addition to that, it's kind of always been known as the cultural capital of Japan. So yeah, very traditional, very old city. I think it's like several thousand years old. There's been like a number of catastrophic fires over the years, right? So it's like every 800 years or something like that, the city burns down. It's one of those really ancient cities. But at the same time, it's a modern Japanese city. So you have kind of like very shiny buildings. Kyoto Station itself is kind of a like big, modern, just huge building with these like mirrored glass panels all around. Is a huge contrast from like all the tradition and all the temples and all the culture that you have in the rest of the city. So yeah, huge contrast, which I think makes it really unique and really interesting. In terms of day-to-day life in Kyoto, like it's not uncommon to see like a group of monks walking down the street, right? Or the maiko, more commonly known as like geisha. Like you'll see them walking to work with all their makeup done and their hair in their the classic maiko hairstyle. And at the same time, you'll just see like salarymen walking to work and things like that, right? So yeah, very, very interesting contrast. But other than that, like I would consider Kyoto and Japan in general a very easy to live in city. The thing about Japan is culturally everything is done by like a rule. Like there's a certain way to do everything, right? There's a certain way to greet people in the morning. There's a certain way to like take your shoes off when you enter someone's home. There's a certain way there's a certain way you go to a convenience store and you pay for your food. There's a certain way to do that, right? And
can you explain one? Like what do you have to do?
Like a convenience store. So yeah, you go, it's not in depth or anything, but the things that the cashier will ask you, right? They're going to be the same exact things every single time. Like they have these rules. So it's like you go there, they'll ask you if you want to buy a bag, right? And they'll ask you to use the same language, like a shopping bag. They'll ask you like how you want to pay. You know, they'll thank you the same way. They'll greet you when you walk into the store. It's all very structured. Coming from the US, I think that's something that is very different, right? Where US people will be a little bit more creative with how they interact with other people, right? When you get used to how things work here in Japan, it makes things very easy because you can just kind of go through your day you can just kind of flow with it, right? Because you know exactly how everything's going to happen. But yeah, everything's very structured for sure. I think that's one of the things that most people have a lot of culture shock with when they first arrive in Japan. I don't know. I was in the train station the other day and there's like arrows telling you, you look at the ground and there's arrows telling you how to get to like the front of the train station, how to get to other train lines. It's like, you just have to look down and follow the arrow. You don't have to explore or anything. You just kind of follow the rules. So yeah, it's fun. It's very different from America, I think.
Do you miss home, or does it feel like home there now after 7 years in some way, or not really?
Yeah, I miss home a lot. I was able to visit the US back a couple of weeks ago now, so maybe 2 weeks ago, for the first time since COVID, actually. And yeah, I miss it. Obviously, friends and family are over there. But there's something about home, right? Like, a home is where the heart is. Like, I could feel really relaxed when I'm there. Not to say that I'm uncomfortable here in Japan. Like, having lived here 7 years, I'm very, very used to it. I'm very comfortable here, but there's something about being home that always feels good, right? I think one of the most striking things is something you're not used to having lived in Japan, and then going back to the US, is the amount of small talk people engage in, right? Like you sit down at a restaurant and the waiter will ask you, how's your day going, right? They'll talk about the menu, things like that. Whereas in here in Japan, you don't get any of that. Straight to business. Okay, what are you going to eat?
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty similar in Scandinavia. They cut out a lot of the chit-chat, at least in Norway. I like the chit-chat.
Yeah, it's nice once in a while, right? Like, you get the feeling that people are, friendly, right?
Yeah. But it's just different. It's just a different...
It really is.
And you settle into it. Obviously, a very popular place to visit. I wanted to hear from you, having lived there for quite a while, what should people see and do when they come to Kyoto? What would you tell people?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think the obvious answers are the temples and the shrines, right? Like, there's Fushimi Inari, which is the shrine with all the torii gates. So you look at it and it's like kind of a tunnel of like orange torii gates that you walk through. It's probably one of the most popular tourist destinations in the world. So if you're a first time traveler, it's definitely a bucket list item, right? It's somewhere that, yeah, you should go look at it. You should go check it out. There's also like the Golden Pavilion, Kinkakuji, which I think everyone has undoubtedly seen a photo of at least once in their life. It's like a temple next to a little pond, and the temple is coated with gold leaf, I think. Like, it's really beautiful, like really ornate building. The third one being Kiyomizudera, which is another large temple that's kind of sitting towards the top of a hill on the east side of town. And you can get really fantastic kind of sunsets looking over the city. So those are
always,
kind of the three.
Always nice.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. yeah, I even though it's kind of a really touristy area, that's somewhere that I still enjoy going to today. Not like, obviously, yeah, I'll take a camera and take photos there, but just kind of enjoy the view. I'm a sucker for like a good sunset over a big cityscape, right?
Yeah,
but I guess who isn't, right? So those are, I think those are the big three kind of tourist locations to visit in the city. That said, they're all going to be very crowded. They're all, obviously, they're the tourist spots. So I always recommend going early as possible, early in the morning. You're going to miss most of the tourists. Yeah, some recommendations for kind of lesser known areas, I would say. I really enjoy going up into the kind of the hills around town. So just east of Kyoto City, there's a mountain called Mount Hiei, Hieizan in Japanese. It's a fairly well-known mountain, I guess you could say. There's a really large temple complex on the summit of the mountain, it's like a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Though I guess most places in Kyoto are UNESCO World Heritage Site, so it's not really saying anything. But you're gonna escape most of the crowds. Plus, you're on top of a mountain, so it's kind of it's a much more natural feeling. Kind of like you're surrounded by nature. Which I think really adds to the ambiance of this place. There's also a lot of history on top of that mountain. I think during the samurai days, one of the Japanese warlords like took an army up there and kind of like massacred an entire village of people or something crazy like that. Lots of history there as well. So that's Mount Hiei. I also enjoy going up to it's called Kurama, and Kifune are kind of two areas on the north part of Kyoto. Again, very similar. You're in the mountains, so you're kind of in the forest, surrounded by the trees, and especially like on a summer day, it's going to feel a lot better because you have that shade to protect you from the sun. Kyoto during the summer, if you're in the city, like it's a nightmare. You're going to be so sweaty and hot. It's so humid. I hate it. so I really like kind of getting out of town into the more natural areas. Kifune and Kurama also kind of, they have like a little village around the area. It's very famous for, they have restaurants out there called, there's a river and they build planks over the river, and the seating is on top of those planks. So you're basically eating your lunch on top of a river, and you get the cooling effect from the river below. They're called yuka, which means floor in Japanese. It's I feel like it's a really great way to kind of escape the city and kind of really just relax a little bit. Very, very peaceful feeling for sure.
Do you speak Japanese?
I speak enough. So my mother, being Japanese, when I was a kid, she would always yell at me in Japanese, right?
So much easier to yell at somebody in your native tongue.
It really is. It really is. Having worked at schools, like, When I yell at, I don't yell at kids, but if I really want to say something like serious, or if I'm feeling upset and I try to say something in Japanese, it doesn't sound right. I always kind of get a blank stare and kind of like, they kind of laugh at me.
Yeah. I joke around with my wife, you know, if we spoke Norwegian all the time with each other, then we'd probably get in a lot less fights, just because if I'm upset and I want to say something, you know, make a crack, or, you know, say, well, you know, you shouldn't have done this. If I have to think about it in Norwegian first, or if I just, it just immediately adds like a layer, you know, between my, my sort of upsettedness and that person. And I'm like, oh, it's just, maybe this isn't a big deal.
It kills the flow, right?
Like, yeah, probably in a good way.
Yeah, I suppose. You can't express the same passion when you're upset in a different language. But yeah, I grew up around a lot of Japanese. I never really studied it formally, but kind of having that exposure as a child and kind of being here in Japan now, it's been much easier for me to kind of just pick it up. And I never really studied it, so I kind of just absorbed it. And at this point, yeah, I could communicate. If I have to communicate, right, I speak to my friends in Japanese. Day-to-day life is no issue. I would say...
Yeah. So you're communicating in Japanese as you go about your day, which obviously makes a big difference with, I think, quality of life, too, when you're living somewhere. It ingratiates you a lot more, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Living in a city in Japan, I would say that knowing Japanese is not, it's not a requirement. Especially in a place like Kyoto, like it's so geared towards tourists now, that everything that you see will be written both in Japanese and English, right?
Just because so many people come to visit.
Yeah, absolutely. That said, if you're going to live in a different country, like the more of the language you understand, the easier your life is going to be, the more convenient it's going to be. Especially if you're say coming to teach English, right? Like you've come here to show other people or to teach other people your language. It's only fair that you take some of their language as well, right? So I always encourage people to try to pick up as much of the language as you can. Japanese itself is a really difficult language to learn, right? Like writing, especially, there's three different writing systems. Thousands of characters to learn, but yeah, just kind of try to learn it little by little. Once you start kind of recognizing things on the street, like you see a street sign or something like that, or maybe you overhear a conversation or even someone's talking to you and they use a word that you just studied, like it feels so good to when you understand it, right? It's like, ah, yes, I communicated, I won, I did it, right?
Yeah. Well, it starts stripping down the sort of, the society opens up in a certain way, right? You're not just floating through a bunch of things you understand, hearing background noise that you don't understand. You start to be a part of it in a different way. I think that really opens up the connection with the country. And then, of course, the people. And I wanted to ask you about the connection for you, because you mentioned wanting to like connect with your heritage. And after all this time there, I'm just wondering, have you like, I don't know if there's a way to define successfully connecting to your heritage. It's a very difficult thing, but what is your feeling on that? Is that something you feel like you've been able to do? And if so, what has that done for you?
I think I've learned a lot about myself. I definitely, like, obviously, like I've gotten to know my family more. I understand the dynamics between my family and on a whole level that I never really understood as a kid. But I feel like a lot of how I act, even before moving to Japan, like I can see part of that Japanese heritage through kind of my day-to-day behavior, even living in the US, right? So for example, I've always been very conscious of kind of my presence, the effect I'm having on the people around me, even in like living in America. Like I would kind of go out of my way to make sure I wasn't like annoying people or things like that, right? And living in Japan, like that's a very Japanese trait. Like in Japan, people are they will go far out of their way to make sure that they're not inconveniencing people around them, or that they're not, you know, making people's lives or people's kind of, people's lives any worse in any way. You know, how you're perceived is a very big thing here in Japan. And that's kind of like looking at that and looking at my own behavior, I've looked at it and said, hey, you know, I could kind of see that in myself. Maybe part of it is because I spent a lot of time here as a kid. My mother is a very loud and outspoken woman. So I didn't get it from her for sure, but you know, from her family, it's definitely possible. Things like that. I kind of see myself as like a mix between my American heritage and Japanese for sure. It's definitely been very eye-opening and a great chance for me to kind of discover more about myself.
Yeah. Without having been there, you might not have recognized these things. And I it's interesting how being in another culture can act as a mirror in a lot of ways to your own behaviors and maybe make you question certain behaviors or certain things about yourself in a different way, and perhaps noticing which of those may be cultural. And it just gives you a heightened awareness, I feel, around a lot of different things. And
absolutely. Yeah.
It makes you start asking questions like, all right, well, you know, am I just behaving this way in these certain situations or whatever the case, or is this like a personality trait that's just within me, or is this something that was kind of just part of my growing up in the cult? Was it just a cultural construct, and is it serving me anymore, even, you know, in some cases, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's it opens up a lot of questions.
It does. I culturally as well. I think one of the most valuable things to me, having like lived in a different country and really kind of gotten to know the culture, is it's allowed me to kind of look back at how things are back home, right? Because I'm in a country where really like everything, every little thing is, the culture is just so vastly different from what we're used to in the US. It kind of opened my eyes to how things are different back home and made me realize, you know, I've never realized this about people in America. I've never realized about like this about how we do things in America. I always thought that was normal, or that's something that I took for granted, right? But then I come to Japan, and it's everything is different. It's like, oh, that's really interesting. Why do they do it this way? And it makes me wonder, why do we do it the way we do back home, right? And it's not to say that, you know, any culture or any way of life is better than the other, right? Like, that's kind of the beautiful part about having different cultures. But it kind of makes you wonder for yourself, like, which one do I like the best? You know, which one works for me? And do we have to do things in this way, or can we take, you know, learn things from this culture as well? Like, I think a really common example is like taking your shoes off when you go inside, right? When you go inside your home. That's something that's very prevalent in Asia and in Japan. And traditionally, I guess in the US, that's not something many people would do. You know, many people just wear their shoes all around the house and whatnot. But it's like, oh, you know, if taking your shoes off, your home stays so much cleaner. You know, you can kind of relax a little bit. You're out of your shoes. Which one's better for me? Like, which one do I like more? And you kind of get to pick and choose aspects of different cultures.
Clearly, taking your shoes off is better. I mean, we do it here in Norway too. And it's like, why would I like walk all over the streets and into the public restroom and then come home and walk with the same shoes in my house? Take your shoes off.
It's kind of mind blowing now that you like think about it, right? It's like,
right,
the outside world is gross. we walk on some disgusting ground, like, but yeah, things like that. I think it's one of the biggest takeaways from living abroad is just kind of learning not only about the culture that surrounds you, but kind of like inspecting how things are back home.
We'll be back in a moment. Here's a quick powerful exercise. If you think about one or two of your big goals, and then you fast forward a few months from now, what can you do right now to give yourself the best chance of succeeding? If one of those goals for you is learning a new language, or even just a little bit of a language to enhance your next trip, you should absolutely get Babbel. They have quick 10-minute lessons handcrafted by over 200 language experts. You can actually start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. It's designed by real people for real conversations, exactly what you want as a traveler. I just downloaded it and went into the Norwegian course area thinking, oh, I've got this. Immediately made a bunch of grammar mistakes that they corrected. And I was like, oh, I've been doing this wrong. So I'm already leveling up and learning. And you can get Babbel now. Here's a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/zerototravel. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/zerototravel, spelled BABBEL.com/zerototravel. Rules and restrictions may apply. Thank you to Babbel for supporting today's show. Hey, you lovely listeners, Jason here. And did you know we have a newsletter and it's free? You can sign up over at zerototravel.com/newsletter. You're going to get money-saving tips, destination advice, some musings, little personal updates, all the stuff that you don't get right here on the podcast, and we can keep in touch. So sign up over there, zerototravel.com/newsletter. Get your weekly dose of travel value, totally free. Thanks for listening. Now let's get back to the show.
In Japan, I feel I've only spent a handful of days in Japan and just in Tokyo, so there's a lot to explore for me. But just having, you know, been exposed to Japanese culture, even if, I mean, it might sound silly, but even going to, like, you know, certain sushi restaurants, or like we went to the Japanese Garden in Portland, Oregon over the summer, and so beautiful. And then we went to the tea house, and when they served the tea, they had such a clever, nice little Zen box thing. It came in and then they poured water and this napkin got bigger, and it was all very, I feel like everything is, there's so much attention to detail in so many ways. I mean, look at Japanese furniture as an example. I mean, you don't have to travel to Japan to know these things, or you read about Zen philosophy or whatever. But then living there, I feel like, you know, mindfulness in that way is really built into the culture in some ways, right? Like, is that true? Have you found that there are aspects of that that have changed your attitude or maybe slowed you down a bit in some ways? I mean, you're from California, so maybe you were already just like, dude, whatever. I'm from the East Coast, so I'm like, let's go. Okay. Here.
You're a go-getter, huh?
Oh, I don't know about that, but I'm a go-getter of coffee, I guess.
You and I have that in common.
Yeah.
Going back to your example of the tea ceremony, I think that's a perfect example of, like, kind of the Japanese, like you said, like how the attention to detail. I've never actually been a part of a real tea ceremony in Japan, but the process itself is, there's so many steps. There's so many things that you have to do, right? Starting from, you're not even inside the room yet, but when you enter the room, there's a certain way that you have to enter the room, right? It's actually really interesting. If you look at a bunch of tea houses, they have like the door that you go in is like a 2-foot by 2-foot hole in the wall. And you kind of have to like bow through it. a lot of doors in Japan are like intentionally kind of low, so you kind of have to bow as you enter the room. kind of an interesting fact. But the tea ceremony, like, right, there's a certain way that you sit, right? There's a tatami mats, the floor mats, and they've got lines built into them where they bind the tatami, where they bind the, they kind of weave it together, and you sit on a certain side of that line on the floor. And the person serving the tea sits on a different side, and you have to sit facing like a certain direction. And the person serving the tea will like stir it a certain way.
It's
right?
All rituals.
It is. It is 100% rituals. But there's so many steps and so detailed. I tried looking through like the steps of a Japanese tea ceremony at one point. I can't remember half of them, right? Like even when you drink the cup, you have to twist it in a certain direction and you have to put the cup back down in a certain way, right?
But that's a great example of, you know, like you could just come and pour a glass of tea, but all of these small things matter. They all contribute to mindfulness, I feel like, in some way. Right. It's hard to slow down in that way, I find, anyway. I just always wonder if living in a place like you live is just kind of slows you down because it can't help itself.
Yeah, in certain ways. Like Japan, I think it's still, I mean, Kyoto is still a very bustling place, right? Like, it's very...
What's that contrast you talked about?
Yeah, absolutely, right? So like you've got, I'm sure everyone has the image of the rush hour trains in the morning and people being pushed into the trains and everyone's rushing to get to work. I'm very lucky that I don't have to take part in that commute. It's to the point where even like a sit-down breakfast restaurant isn't really a thing in Japan unless you're staying at like a high-end hotel or a ryokan, which is like a big fancy Japanese inn, because people don't have time to go out and eat breakfast, right? People are rushing out the door to get to work. But yeah, at the same time, like so much of the culture is based around taking things slowly and kind of being aware of your surroundings, right? Paying attention to little details. You spend any time in a Japanese temple and just kind of observe the details and how immaculate the craftsmanship of not just the artifacts in the temple, but the building itself, right? A lot of traditional buildings in Japan will have this like sliding doors, kind of made of, they're kind of made of paper, but they have like really immaculate paintings on them that were all hand drawn, hand painted, I should say. And yeah, just kind of people really appreciate kind of that mastery of like that attention to detail. People will devote their lives to doing these things. And You can't do that when you're you're rushing to work every day, right? I guess maybe if you're rushing to the place where you're gonna go paint a door, that's one thing. But yeah, you take your time with everything and you do it right. You do it in a way that you kind of appreciate the craft.
Well, I mean, I can certainly see that attitude, or at least I feel that when I look at your photos. I feel like you're doing the same with your photography. And I wanted to make sure that people could check it out. If they're curious, maybe you could dish us a couple photos here to put on the show notes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of course, taromoberly.com, and I can link on the show notes there. And you want to just let everybody know where they can get the book and all that if they're curious to go a step further. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely a lot of times when I try to slow down with my photography. Actually, I'd say my biggest criticism of my own photography is that I don't slow down enough. a lot of times I'm pretty, we like to say run and gun, kind of just like go, go, go. But I think it is when I slow down and kind of really think about what I want to photograph is when I can do my best work, right? Taking photos on the street, that's a lot of kind of anticipation, right? You kind of find the setting that you want to take a photo of, and you want the right character to kind of wander through that frame, things like that. And, you know, sometimes that photo never comes, right? And that's okay. It's part of the process. You kind of have to learn to accept that. But then when you do get the photo, it feels so much better, right? Because it's the one that you've been trying over and over and over again, and you finally get it. It's like, accomplished it. Yeah.
Yeah, man. I mean, I'm no photo critic here, so you're not going to hear me speak intelligently as a commentary on these photos. But I can tell you that just looking at them inspires me to go and experience these moments for myself, whatever version of those moments I can experience on the ground. And I just love the aesthetic and the sort of the, I don't know what the, I wouldn't call it a filter, but there's a certain...
The look.
Yeah, there's a certain look and feel and sort of like, yeah, aesthetic, I guess, that kind of binds all these together. I think it's really cool. Anyway, we'll link to the Instagram and all the things. And if you want to check out the photo book in Kyoto, is coming out very soon at the time of this recording. So it should be out by the time this drops to you. Taro, man, just want to say, appreciate your time today. Let's stay in touch if we can.
Yeah, for sure. Come visit Kyoto sometime, Jason.
Would love to. Take care.
All right. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
There you have it. I want to thank Taro Moberly once again for stopping by the show and sharing a bit about his life in Kyoto, Japan. We've got one more week left of Destinations Month. It's not like we're not going to cover destinations the rest of the year, but I had a lot of destination-themed episodes, so I thought packing them in this month would be a fun thing to do. Hope you're enjoying it as much as I'm enjoying bringing it to you. Before I let you slip and slide out of here and get about your day, I do have a few things to share that I mentioned at the top. And we'll start with this shout out to a listener right here in this community who's kickstarting a life of travel. And I love where he took the time to record this voicemail for me. Here it is.
My name is Brett Hunter. I'm from Perth, Australia. I've just started my travel journey. I'm currently in an airport at Senai Airport in Malaysia. It's honestly been a hard couple of days adjusting to this new life that I am starting for a while. And yeah, I've been listening to your podcast for the last year, and it's really gotten me off the ground for what I am, for this travel journey that I'm on. So I say thank you very much, and I hope to continue listening to your podcast for a long time into the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Brett, and congratulations. I love that you took the time to do that at the airport. I mean, literally out on the road right there, right now. And it's always wonderful to share these community voicemails, to share these stories. And I think this one's a good reminder of the fact that sometimes we work so hard to set ourselves up for a trip or a gap year or whatever the case is, even just a 2 week or 1 week or weekend vacation. And it's not always smooth right in the beginning, right? Like Brett said, he's having a bit of a hard time these first couple days adjusting to this new life. And it is really a new life when you've sort of left everything behind. You're taking off for a longer term period of time, and that's okay. So if you're out there and you're just starting out on a trip, or if you're getting ready to, don't get discouraged if, you know, those first couple days, couple weeks, even month, whatever the case is for you, it's a bit of an adjustment period, like there is for everything in life. Just because we achieved our goal doesn't necessarily mean there aren't going to be some challenges right away with that. It's always challenging to kind of open up a new chapter in life. So anyway, I'm sure, Brett, you're going to thrive and enjoy your time out on the road. And I just wanted to publicly acknowledge your accomplishment here on the podcast. Congratulations for doing what it takes to get out there to live your travel dream. If you have a story you want to share, travel tip, anything you want to share with the community, really, just want to say hi. You can always leave me a voicemail. I have a link in all of the show notes. Very easy to do. No email required. Just push a button. Takes 90 seconds or less. Go ahead and do that if you want to get in touch. Okay. Let's see. Two things. Japanese proverb coming in a second. First, the song pairing. Of course, I mean, I wish I had the rights to this so I could play it right now at the end of the show, but I don't. Phoebe Bridgers has a song called Kyoto. It's got a banging horn section. And if you've never heard the song Kyoto, you can search that wherever you stream music by Phoebe Bridgers. Cool song. I like it. Different take on Kyoto than we heard today in the interview. And this Japanese proverb, like I said at the top, this is something that we can carry with us throughout the year. Something to keep us strong, keep us going whenever things get tough, which they inevitably do, or things happen. And it goes like this. Fall down 7 times, get up 8 times. Love it. Thanks. Thanks for your time today. You've got like how many millions of podcasts to choose from, and you're here. It's part of the Zero Travel community. I can't tell you how much that means to me. So really a heartfelt thank you, and hope you enjoyed today's show. And I look forward to seeing you next week. Peace and love to you and yours. Have a great day. Cheers.
This podcast has been brought to you by ZeroToTravel.com. Ideas and advice to make your travel dreams a reality.